is because of the financial crisis of 2008. I think the metaverse doesn't necessarily have to limit itself to being digital. I think it's already here today in the physical. We see this as the ground zero.
Herzlich willkommen bei Digitale Optimisten. Ich bin Alex und wir tauchen in dieser Folge tief ein in die Erfolgsstrategien eines Gründers, der mit seinem Startup Großes erreichen will. Heute haben wir ein echtes Brett von einer Folge. Brett deshalb, weil wir uns endlich dem Thema nähern, was das Hype-Thema 2022 ist, auch wenn das Jahr 2022 sicher nicht in die Annalen von Startups als besonders tolles Jahr eingeht. Aber es ist natürlich Krypto, Web3 und Metaverse. Die Hohepriester von Web3 und Krypto verkünden schon das Ende des alten Internets und den Beginn eines ganz neuen Aufbruchs in ein gelobtes, dezentralisiertes Land, wo die Mittelmänner wie Facebook und Google ausgeschaltet und disrupted werden. Andere Stimmen sagen, dass wir mitten in einem Hype-Cycle sind und das Ende am Ende gar nicht so disruptiv und dezentral ist, wie man das vielleicht jetzt denkt. Was auch immer es auch wird, ich glaube, es gibt kaum ein spannenderes Thema, was sich lohnt zu verstehen. Wir haben in der Vergangenheit auch schon Chris Schmidt von ApolX zu Gast gehabt. Ich empfehle dir die Folge sehr. Die war total spannend. Da haben wir uns dem NFT-Markt genähert. Und jetzt geht es in meinem persönlichen Lernprozess auch weiter mit dem nächsten Web3-Gründer. Wir sprechen nämlich heute mit Tim Dirksen, dem CEO und Gründer von Venly. Venly verkauft gewissermaßen Schaufeln für den Web3-Gründer. Goldrausch. Das heißt, es ermöglicht traditionellen Unternehmen, Use Cases auf der Blockchain zu entwickeln. Etwas technischer gesagt, baut es die API-Schnittstelle, mit der traditionelle Entwickler was anfangen können und dadurch auf die Möglichkeiten verschiedener Blockchains zuzugreifen. Ja, viele Buzzwords jetzt schon, aber damit meine ich zum Beispiel das Erschaffen und Verwalten von NFTs, Non-Fungible Tokens, dem Handeln von NFTs und so weiter. Falls du keine Ahnung davon hast, kein Problem, du musst nicht abschalten, denn wir verbringen die ersten Minuten damit, langsam in das ganze Konstrukt Web3, Metaverse und Blockchain einzusteigen. Ja, dieser Podcast Digital Optimisten dreht sich um smarte Geschäftsideen und wie man sie erfolgreich macht. Deshalb kriegst du jetzt auf digitaloptimisten.de die Möglichkeit, einen Newsletter zu abonnieren, mit dem du regelmäßig neue, wirklich frische Geschäftsideen, die du garantiert so noch nirgendwo gesehen hast, in deine Inbox bekommst. Falls Newsletter nichts für dich sind, dann empfiehl doch gerne deiner smartesten Freundin oder deinem klügsten Freund von diesem Podcast. Aber genug der Vorrede, jetzt ab ins Interview mit Tim. Viel Spaß und bis bald. Tim, welcome to Digitale Optimisten. I'm really happy to have you. Where does this podcast find you?
Where does this podcast find me? Yes. Here in Belgium. I'm sitting here in Belgium. It's still a little bit rainy out here. So, yeah.
In Antwerp, right?
The company is actually in Antwerp. But 2 years ago when COVID struck, we decided to be 100% digital. And we actually closed down our office. So everybody's working now remotely from home.
Got it. And you didn't decide to move to Portugal. You stuck with Belgium.
Yes. Funny story. All of the founders, they have wives, and the wives, they have children. So along with the wives and children, we decided to stay here because nobody really wants to move away. So we're a little bit stuck in that predicament.
Okay, God. But there's worse places to be than in Belgium, I guess. It's been a long time since I've been. But I guess I have to come because, you know, obviously there's some great startups coming out of Belgium, but we'll be talking about that in a second. So, Tim, let me kick off our conversation with maybe an unusual question. What was the last big purchase with real money you made for fun?
Last big purchase with real money that I made for fun. Damn, that's actually a good one.
Did you buy a car? Did you buy an espresso machine?
No, that's a good one. I actually bought the car.
There we go.
I bought a car 2 weeks ago. I was driving BMW 1 for the past 7 or 8 years. And my accountant was saying, Tim, it's really time that you have to get a new car because the fiscal climate is changing. Get a hybrid or get an electric car. One of the two. I don't care which one.
Okay, so tax-driven decision for a car. That's good. Because why did I ask this question? Because obviously the mission of your company is, you know, thinking about the financial system, how to decentralize monetary funds, and you know, how can we pay in the future? So we're going to have a little bit. We're going to be talking about that quite a bit. But you were also active on Quora for a bit some time ago. It's a couple of years ago. And I found a little bit about what I think makes you tick on that site. Because I read your self-description, and you put in your self-description on Quora, you wrote, a reader, thinker, blogger, dreamer with the driving passion to help you answer the burning question of who do you aspire to be?
Yeah,
that's pretty big. So who do you aspire to be, Tim?
Well, when I look at who I'm being right now, is I dedicate my work and my life to build the best team and the best company possible. And from the earliest of, I would say, 2014, I got to learn about blockchain technology. And for me, it clicked. I understood what the concept was, what we were going to do with smart contracts, what the vision of the future could look like. And since then, I've always been an ambassador, creating the companies or the products and the tools to make that possible. And now I try to find that that dream within that company that we're building.
So that's really cool. So you're saying you got a vision of the future and you want to found a company with the best people to build that future. Is that right?
In a nutshell, yes. That's how we actually work as a team to build that future together.
That's cool. So yeah, that's really interesting. So let's start unpeeling the onion, I guess, right? Because your company is active in maybe the most hyped space there is going into 2022. And we might have to ease into this a little bit, because I know that some of our listeners are real experts when it comes to Web3, crypto, metaverse, NFTs, and so on. Others might be at the beginning of that learning curve. So we kind of need to walk a fine line here, easing into the topic. So why don't we start with an example of how the world and the web, what some, many people call the web 2, works today. And I'll suggest we take the music industry. And the way that I see it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but there are thousands of music creators and podcasters, some very big, some very small out there, obviously. And there are millions of people who enjoy listening to music. It appears pretty hard currently to connect those two spheres, both those music creators and those people listening to music. So a smart guy in Sweden came up with the idea of Spotify, introducing a middleman between those two user groups, creators and users, aggregate all the music and offer it to all those music lovers out there for whatever, 10 euro per month. And now Web3 and the whole underlying technology of crypto wants to change all this. So maybe you could help me understand, how would this concept of the music industry and the problem that we have there look in Web3 with blockchain technology?
Yes, that's a really good example that you have of Web2 there. I'm not entirely sure whether that is the model that we're going to disrupt with blockchain technology. And I think the model that Spotify has, or the streaming as a service model, is going to go away. I think it offers a lot of value. And if you're then on the couch listening to Spotify and you want to hear the music, you don't necessarily want to own that music that you're listening to. You just get the right to listen to it because you pay a license. And that's fine. But there are other business models where you're going to say, I do care about owning something, either the digital ownership or the physical ownership or something. And when you're going to do a transaction of value from one stakeholder to another stakeholder, as in I'm really owning something now, their blockchain technology makes sense. Their monetization model around the technology makes sense.
But okay, so that's interesting that you say it's not that relevant for the music industry because...
I'm saying it is very relevant for the music industry, but if it's the model as in I want to have streaming as a service and the end users, they just want to pay a license to listen to it, that model is not going to go away. If you're going to create a fandom and a community between an artist and a fan, and you, for example, want to have a direct line with a particular fan, then you can create assets around digital ownership where you can say, you know what, if you purchase this asset from me, or if I give you this asset, that will give you something from me as an artist. And that is next to what they're doing in actually making these deals to enable their music to be listened to, on Spotify. So I think there's a different model and a different breadth that you can bring towards the music industry through blockchain technology.
Interesting. So if I understand you correctly, you're saying, well, both of our approaches, basically, the way that we looked at the problem was, how could we empower the creators in a way to be more, let's say, to have more ownership of their stuff or to give away that ownership if they choose, right? And you're saying, hey, you know, if you're a Jay-Z and have a huge fan base, you might be able to tokenize or make, I don't know, NFTs out of your songs and distribute that to your fan base who could then actually be owners of the catalog of the stuff that you created.
Indeed. And I think there are different goals that you want to create. If you're saying I'm going to create music and I want the world to hear, then you of course want it broadcasted on different media. And the more it's broadcasted, the less you actually own a specific item. Mm-hmm. But if you're creating a community of fans and that you're saying, okay, these are the people that are coming to each and every live concert, these are the people that are tweeting about me and are giving me a good presence in the media. For them, you might want to give them something else. And there, I think there's a model that sits aside that. And yes, you can still use smart contracts in the background of Spotify so that you can distribute who gets which percentage of the money when people listen to it through Spotify, right? There's still a business value around that. But nowadays, what you see is a lot of the fans, they're looking at fan engagement. A lot of the brands are looking at fan engagement.
Fan engagements.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And tell me, you know, I heard that there are a couple of use cases with, you know, in the music industry of, let's say you, I don't know, you make an NFT out of, let's say, a ticket stub to a concert, right? You say, hey, you know, I can actually use this. And maybe this is not the best example, but you are, if you tokenize such an item, let's say maybe a shirt from a tour, right? Whatever, something, you tokenize it, and then you are able to resell it. And or if there's a market for resale, not sure I took the best example there, but then you would be able to build a smart contract and also that the music creator would be able to participate on subsequent sales of, that's true, right? That's kind of the smart contract bit in the blockchain.
Yes, indeed. And I think your ticket stub is actually the perfect example. The only difference what you're seeing here today is when you're going to purchase a ticket, you're going to purchase that on your own name. And the ticket masters or the people that are promoting that, they obviously only want you, the purchaser, to be the one that can go to the concert because that is the primary sale that happens. Currently, there's no model for them to have like secondary sales where they take a percentage of revenue if somebody would resell tickets. And that is what smart contracts would do. It brings that transparency that says, well, I'm going to bring out 1,000 tickets and the ownership of the ticket, I don't really mind if it's Alex or if it's Tim. If you're the first one that buys it, if you want to resell it to me. In some cases, they don't mind that because you as the primary purchaser, you purchase the ticket, all the revenue goes to the company. But if you resell it, then a percentage of your revenue still goes to the company.
That's really interesting. And that is what I think is a novel concept, right? Because you make things tradable and you kind of empower the initial person who issued something to participate on subsequent sales. I think one of the best examples that I feel is in the art industry. Because, I mean, if you paint a picture, if you're Pablo Picasso, you sell it once, right? So you sell it once and that's it. Some collector buys it and that collector might make a nice premium if he or she continues to sell it to someone else. But you're just going to have the initial price. But if you're able to have this live on a blockchain and a smart contract, you might be able to benefit as original Pablo Picasso creator of subsequent sales and be able to, you know, participate in the, let's say, you know, increasing value of this. And this is what I find really interesting. Let me take this concept now. We talked about art and music, but crypto is obviously also something that is being heralded as something that might be able to disrupt traditional finance, banking. And I think that's also where your company started, you know, and thinking about the crypto and the finance world and how it might disrupt finance. Could you give us just a short, you know, I don't know if it's possible, just a short idea of, you know, what the promise is of a more decentral banking system through blockchain and crypto?
Yeah, if you then just look at the origin as to why blockchain came to pass, why Bitcoin came to pass, is because of the financial crisis of 2008. What happened there was a complete financial meltdown. Banks went under, and of course, a lot of people, they actually lost a lot of money. And what also really happened, I don't know if many people remember this, if you wanted to take out your money from the bank, it was not possible. So everybody that went to the ATMs were locked, and everyone was locked out of their own funds. This, of course, creates hysteria and panic. And it's one of the reasons where if you look at the blockchain network, and you then own, of course, your own wallet, that is the end philosophy, then you can say, well, you cannot lock me out of having my own account through blockchain technology and having that crypto. So it's also a safe haven for if there would be a financial crisis.
So, okay. So I understood the concept of, you know, the blockchain. What role do Bitcoin, Ether, and all the other crypto coins play in this concept?
Ooh, all the other crypto coins. Bitcoin, it plays a big role because it's the mother of all currencies that exist. I do think it's a safe haven in terms of being an alternative to invest in, or to rather be an alternative to invest in gold or anything like that. Ethereum is, for me, a different concept. The Ethereum blockchain is really built around smart contracts. It's to enable businesses to build a monetization model on top of that. And the currency Ether is just to make it the chain work. Whereas other currencies that live on top, that are, for example, what you would call a utility token, those would drive smaller economies within a specific application. Does that make a little bit sense?
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, I think this is a very important distinction between that there are different coins with different purposes. Bitcoin, as you mentioned, what did you say again? Kind of a storage of value. But Ethereum and Ether as kind of an infrastructure to enable smart contracts. And some of the things we talked about in the art world and the music world seem to be perfect for such a smart contract-based a blockchain, such as Ether and Ethereum. Can you help me? What are some of the, you know, most interesting use cases you see around smart contracts today?
Most interesting? There are so many different ones, right? But if you look at supply chain certification of the process, I would see that as a very interesting one to actually put on chain, because then you create an open infrastructure around all the certification processes.
What does that mean, Tim? What does that mean in supply chain? So do you mean that, you know, So that you see what where the wheat comes from, where all the ingredients come from?
Indeed. That's like the Farm to Fork initiative. If you currently want to have a solution that is eco-friendly or anything, then you have to trust the labels that position, okay, this particular type of coffee is essentially a good one because it's labeled by what do you call it, like a Greenpeace or one of the what you call it,
some of those certificates, right? You know, that say, hey, this is a bio, this is a bio label, this is
So because you have the bio label, you trust that it's actually a good one. But instead of just trusting the label, you could put processes in place that say, okay, and during every step of the time, we're going to certify that that transaction really happened, that it really is from that particular farmer, that they are eco-friendly, that they're doing the process as it should be. And then you can go from start to finish and you can track the provenance of what you actually are eating. For example, a piece of steak, you can track, okay, this came from that cow. It went to supplier X, Y, and Z, and in the end, it landed on my plate, and you can track it on the blockchain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I can see the real world application there. Some other things that were, you know, were smart contracts and the whole concept of blockchain took quite a foothold is in gaming, I feel. I mean, there's been examples, I worked for Google, back before I moved back to Germany, and I was quite involved in the app space. And when I first heard that there's a new concept called play to earn, I found this incredibly interesting because there used to be things like free to play, you know, where you just download something and you know, play a game and you might buy some new items for real money. But now games like Axie Infinity introduce something that is called play to earn. You can actually earn money. And I believe they're also based on smart contracts. How does that work?
If you look at how they actually do it, it's not about the technical matter, but it's about creating a community that wants to be involved within that particular game. And that's what's so different with free to play at the moment. As in, that business model is completely, has completely changed. Let's take a free-to-play game. Everybody knows Fortnite, and what you want is you have millions of, even billions of players that are playing that on a daily basis. The game is free, but everything that you purchase in-game, in-app, is quite expensive. Like a skin that the user buys can go up to $7 or $20 or sometimes $60 just to have a particular skin to have that in the game. Every time you're doing that purchase, you're actually buying it from the game studio itself. So this is their main monetization model. So they're always, the naming, they're monetizing the consumer.
Mm-hmm. So they put out the skins, they put out the levels, and you can actually buy it.
Exactly. And it's all about behavioral psychology. They have to develop the game that's so exciting, that's so fun to play, but that the people actually want to spend more to level up and to participate in the game. And there are always several reasons that they want to do it. They focus around a specific desire, a desire to compete, a desire to win, a desire to build, a desire to, you name
just
it.
Be better, yeah, got it, compete. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Just to be better. And where the play-to-earn model, they understand that there are so many types of players within the game, and they want to treat it into a way that everybody that is contributing to the game, they actually don't always monetize the consumer. They want them to be a stakeholder within the ecosystem. So if you spend time over there, instead of always buying that skin or that item from the game studio, what the game studio is going to do is, well, I'm going to create a smart contract, I'm going to create digital assets, and I'm going to make my model scarce. So I'm not going to have 100 million items available for each and every player that they always have to buy from me. I'm going to limit the supply, but I'm going to enable my consumer to create the demand. So the gamers, they are positioning to play a game, which is they're becoming increasingly more fun. And the more time that they spend there, instead of just wasting time and having their desires being met, competing, winning, and playing, they get the side benefit of earning. And sometimes that side benefit of earning is actually a major benefit, because if you look at Axie Infinity, or a particular example, a lot of people that are playing in the Philippines, they're earning $5 to $10 a day. $5 to $10 a day for them is actually a lot of money.
Yeah, let's double click on that, because I think it's one of the most interesting kind of trends out there. And I think it's kind of a paradigm shift. And it, at the same time, it visualizes very well what the blockchain and smart contracts and NFTs, and that for that matter, can do. So I think, and please correct me, Tim, if I'm wrong here, but the way that Axie Infinity works is, first you have to, it's basically like, how could you describe it? It's like a Pokemon game, basically, right? You have little monsters like Pokemon, and you fight other players, and the best, you know, combat skilled Pokemon, or Axie, how they call it, wins. And if you win such a match with another player, you earn, I forgot what the what it's called again, the in-game token that you earn.
I believe it's AXS.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, you win some AXS, and that is actually real. I mean, that's a, you can exchange that into a token, and that is actually something you can cash out, right? So you play the game, you beat other players, you could become better, and you earn an in-game currency that is actually tradable on the blockchain, to simplify it a little bit, and you can cash it out into real dollars.
Yes.
And the way that I find, I mean, at first I thought, you know, okay, so how do the game developers make money? But I think that's a really interesting thing, is you have to purchase these Axies, these Pokemon, in order to play. And when I checked a couple of months ago, when the price was really up there, it cost like almost $800 to purchase one Axie, one of those little Pokemons. Is that right? So Tim, you know, that's, I mean, that's totally changed the way that games work.
Yeah, it's built on that scarce model, right? So if you want an Axie, there is a limited supply. If you want that from a specific generation, and this is then what the game needs to do. They need to make sure that it's not just about supply limitation, it's about creating the demand for it, and also making sure that it continues to exist. Mm-hmm. Why is an Axie from the first generation more more valuable than an Axie from the latest generation?
Mm-hmm.
It's increasingly difficult for a game studio to think about all the business models around how they want to develop it around a blockchain economy. Most game developers, they don't take into account these complexities at the get-go, and then they risk a point of failure where the NFTs or the assets aren't as valuable, because in the end, the demand that they get just does not drive that value. That's what companies like The Sandbox or Axie Infinity have done right.
And that is, I think, you know, you're touching on something which adds to my fascination on this topic, is if you think about it, the way that people use these, you could, it's almost like a little economy in a game, because you have to purchase these Axies, and they are kind of expensive. They're even like, they're even what they call scholarship programs out there, where people who own an Axie, so they purchase something. It's a non-fungible token. It's an NFT. So it's a uniquely identified thing, you know, that has unique characteristics and is even maybe a good or a bad fighter. They loan these Axies to players in the world who might not be able to afford at the time $800. And then they fight for them, and they, you know, kind of agree on a revenue share, and they call this a scholarship model. So the way that the, I mean, you might have to employ like a chief economist in a game now, no?
Indeed, that is completely correct. And these models are not simple, right? They're complicated, but they serve to meet the needs of creating that economy. What else, there was another thing that you mentioned, that you said that you have to buy them. That's not correct. It's just easier to buy them to reach to a certain stage. What you can also do is play the game for long enough time and then you earn them. That's the play to earn function.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. Yeah, and I think you understand why I find this so interesting is because it just flips over, you know, the way that games work. And if you look at Axie, of course, the price has been dropping quite substantially after news broke on Forbes that the Philippines are, you know, going crazy for this game. Mm-hmm. But it's just something that really mixes up the way that games are played. And maybe this is a good transition to talk about the metaverse, because I think it's, you know, it's easy to get confused by all the things that are floating around. Web3, you know, there's a blockchain that, you know, is the basis of Web3, but there's Mark Zuckerberg with his metaverse. And a lot of people picture like a person wearing VR goggles and talk about the metaverse. But if you were to define Axie Infinity as kind of a metaverse, because it kind of mm-hmm. introduces its own economy, its own rules. You can live there and earn money. I mean, isn't that already kind of a metaverse?
For me, I would say yes, that is a metaverse. And the more open and connected it is with other games and platforms and applications, that really drives what I would call a metaverse. An open world and that can be interconnected with each other.
So what you're saying is there is no one big metaverse like the internet, but there will be many smaller, you know, like the Sandbox, which we can also talk about, which is also a game where you can acquire real estate and, you know, yeah. do stuff, or Axie Infinity, where you play a game. So you see, I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around the metaverse, but is that the way you see it?
I think the metaverse doesn't necessarily have to limit itself to being digital. I think it's already here today in the physical. I'll give you an example. We're talking to artists and game studios, music rappers and brands that want to come together and play around in a particular metaverse. Or what happens if a DJ is doing a street is doing a concert? They're doing a concert on Tomorrowland or another exciting stage that they want to be on, but then they're also streaming that to be available within one or multiple games. People that can't go to the physical concert, the people that are playing a game, there could be a game that there has a concert hall in there, and the game has the license to stream that. And everybody that purchased a ticket within the game, they can actually view the live stream of the concert of that particular person right then and there. And that is, for me, a metaverse. Something is happening in the real world. You're projecting it within the game. In-game, there's a separate economy going in there, but it's still connected to the streaming rights that are created in the real world. And this is where the digital economy meets the physical economy, or the real-world economy.
So you really mix it and connect the two. Yeah, I remember there were some really, I mean, when I saw the numbers, there were a couple of rappers giving, you know, giving concerts in, I don't know if it was Fortnite or others, yeah. or maybe even Sandbox, and the numbers were crazy of people who actually joined. But do you think that people will truly enjoy such a digital experience? I mean, can it keep up with the real thing?
Good question. I don't know, because I've never been to a concert myself. But I think for everyone his own. What is the real thing? Is the real thing having a face-to-face meeting and making sure that everyone has to be in an office and that can drive a good company? Or for us, we're doing a digital company and we're growing faster than we've ever done before. We can say exactly the same thing. It's not the same as a face-to-face meeting. But it is more productive, it is more convenient, it is cheaper for us to do so. So if you're playing around in a game within your own bedroom and you're a type of person that really enjoys that music, you enjoy the atmosphere, but you don't necessarily need to be there to experience it, then yeah, I think for a particular group of people, it would be a better experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let me ask you about Facebook, because I think, you know, after Mark Zuckerberg went on stage and, you know, said, hey, we're going to be called Meta now, and they made this big PR push towards the metaverse, I think that's what got this concept onto the radar of many people. And the thing that I'm always at odds with is when I listen to you, Tim, then you talk about the decentral nature of Web3, of blockchain, and all things associated. But at the same time, there's this guy from Web2 who is, you know, just that middleman, you know, who has been kind of monopolizing a lot of the stuff that we think of as the internet today, of the Web2. So, I mean, how are you? What's your perspective on Mark Zuckerberg taking this big, being really bullish and really long on the metaverse when he is kind of the embodiment, what I would think, of, you know, what Web3 is actually trying to disrupt, the middle man?
Yeah, that's another difficult conversation to have, right? On my end, I'm not 100% Web3, and I'm not 100% Web2. I believe there's a middle ground. Does it mean that I don't want there to be middlemen? No, I believe there has to be middlemen. We are middlemen ourselves. We're a middleman between a blockchain network and how a business would be able to integrate that. But what we do really enjoy about Web3 is those monetization models that really differ compared to a Web2 model. And I don't know how Mark or Meta is going to continue their own business model or monetization model around Facebook and Meta, but it could be that they would go into a dynamic shift, and that they would reward the contributors to actually be a part of the social platform.
Okay. So that's a very balanced position. I think some people in this space, they might be even a bit more feisty about that, you know, and kind of defend the decentral concept. But it's interesting that you take a nuanced perspective. Maybe.
It's one of the things, right? Our whole thesis is Web3 is broken. It's very hard for businesses and end users to engage with Web3. So we, as a tech provider, as a service provider, we try to connect the two and try to have an unbiased opinion of each, because we want Web3 to succeed. But 99% of all businesses, they use Web2 technology. So we have to create the technology in such a way that a Web2 business or a Web2 consumer, they can say, you know what, I want to have a blockchain wallet, but I don't know how to manage my own keys. So I need a service provider in between just to help me out. And in this sense, you want one that can facilitate but not intrude. And that's the balance that we try to bring at Venly.
That might be an excellent segue to talk about Venly, right? The company that you founded. So, as you said, you know, on your website it says Venly wants to make the blockchain accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. And maybe it helps to ease into what you do by looking at the user groups that you serve. And I feel, and please correct me, that there are two user groups that you serve. There's the developers and, let's say, the regular users, right, who might need a wallet and stuff. So let me maybe talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old. How do developers benefit from using Venly?
A developer can benefit by using Venly if they don't have any blockchain experience. Right now, to use blockchain is a huge disruption, right? Because it wasn't taught in school. Only now schools are having a curriculum to understand blockchain. Most businesses that are out there 5 or 10 years they don't have the bandwidth to retrain everyone to understand, okay, let's develop around blockchain and smart contracts. Let's do away with all of our processes that we have to date. They just got onto the cloud. Cloud has been here for the past 10 or 12 years, but only in the past 2 or 3 years they're onboarding on that. So if they're going to need to make a decision to use blockchain to make a build decision themselves, that's going to be a huge investment for the company, which is, it isn't their primary goal. So then they would need a service provider that says, you know what, my developer that is working for my company today, I am from management, have an idea to launch a monetization model or a business concept around blockchain technology. But the people that I have on staff today, they can understand our documentation and our products and services that we bring so that they can integrate blockchain into their own processes.
Got it. Okay. So basically what you do, a bit more technical, say, you know, there's APIs. A lot of people, all developers know how to use APIs. It's a way to connect to let's say, to products, how they talk to each other, how they connect. And you say, let us take care of the blockchain part. We're going to build a nice little API on top of it so that you just need to know how to build an API and we do the communication to the blockchain functions.
Indeed. And so we have a suite of APIs.
Yes, and tell me, you know, what are the use cases that companies would use your API for?
That has changed a lot over time. In the beginning, we didn't really have a go-to-market strategy. So you could say you can use it for fintech, you can manage your own crypto portfolio, you can build an exchange on top of our products. And we've seen companies do that. We also have, for example, a platform that built a white label solution for Greenpeace. They're creating some type of Kickstarter platform, but then they use a tokenized model behind it so that everyone that invests into one of those projects, they get a tokenized reward in return. But since the last 2 years, we've really been diving down the road of gaming and metaverses because we see this as the ground zero. Whenever looking into new technology adoption, gaming has always been one of the first. And with the metaverses and with the smart contracts, we've also seen, and this is quite unusual, sports and music being very excited because they're understanding this is all about licensing. It's about licensing models. If I can change the way I create licensing deals and I can use functions like a smart contract to support me on that, and I can connect that closer to my consumers, then there's a whole plethora of use cases that are coming up.
Could you name a couple or one that excites you most?
Well, one that is doing very well at the moment is the whole Sandbox. Sandbox is a game studio creating that virtual economy. It's a big user-generated platform. So they actually have built a world, which is virtual. It's in the browser. And it's going to enable 3 or 4 types of stakeholders. You have people that want to buy the land because they're people that want to invest and have something built on top of that. Then within that, they also have people that develop games. So they have to develop a game on top of the land. Then you have artists that have to create digital assets. And then you have brands that want to have IP that are represented and are part of that land. So, for example, Roller Coaster Tycoon, The Walking Dead, or The Smurfs. These are just like 3 IPs that they've attracted to participate in land to build a mini game or a mini world within that game. And then you have the players themselves. And all of these stakeholders, they're participating in that digital economy. And every asset that is being traded over there is a blockchain-based asset.
Understood. So basically, you provide all the tools for, you know, the Sandbox and every brand, every person participating, every user to be able to mint, you know, to produce these NFTs or whatever tokens you're thinking about. And then
you know, have an exchange where people can say, hey, you know, I got this item or I want to exchange this currency for another. That's basically what you're doing.
Yes. Now for the sandbox, what we're doing for them is the user onboarding. So whenever people are learning about the sandbox on Google, Twitter, Facebook, or anywhere that they start to see it and they click through, 9 times out of 10, a new user, they would use our services to be onboarded onto the sandbox. So we're the primary onboarding service for them. Smart contracts, this sandbox does, of course, themselves, because this is also a party that has been in the space now for the past 2 to 3 years. But what you're saying, yes, we would be able to provide all the services for new game studios that want to launch, and they can use the wallet technology, minting technology, marketplace technology, and we provide that as a service, and that on multiple chains that we support.
Got it. So, I mean, how big can Venli get? You know, what's your grand vision? What's the market potential here?
It's actually it's bigger than I imagined for a couple of reasons. We were in the space quite early, and we always built our the solutions to the problems that we had, and then the solutions to the problems that our clients were having. And that landed us into creating what I would say right now, the three main criteria: wallet solutions, NFT tools, and marketplace solutions. We don't see many partners or platforms out there that can do all three. And since we've been working a lot in the gaming space and we saw the e-commerce companies coming on, we've also integrated our services into Web2 businesses.
And like Shopify, for example, right? I saw that on your website.
Indeed. So we also are supporting Shopify in the back end to enable NFTs. And that makes us a platform player that can really support most of the Web2 businesses that are now starting to get into the adoption of Web3. And if you're looking at, are they going to make a build decision or a buy decision, it's increasingly more favorable for them to leverage a service like ours, because they want to go to market quickly, because it's not just a hype anymore. They understand that there's real world value by using blockchain technology.
So let's take an example here. So imagine Amazon would be saying, you know, you can buy books and real world stuff on our platform already, but we want to open our marketplace up for digital items, digital NFTs. Then they might be able to say, well, we can build it ourselves and build up a team that does what you guys do. Or they could say, hey, let's use Venli's turnkey solution and they'll help us to, you know, offer these the blockchain technology behind it and stuff to be able to sell NFTs.
Yes. Technically, that would be 100% possible. The only question that you then need to make is, a company like Amazon, are they going to build their own blockchain network and have everything be a closed network that they offer themselves? Or are they going to support the public network? And if they choose to support the public network, then it would 100% make sense to use a service like ours.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And tell me, what's the biggest challenge that you guys have at Venli? Is that sales? Is that, you know, getting more blockchains integrated with the APIs? What is the thing that keeps you awake at night?
The biggest thing is, I believe we have to move forward on two growth trajectories. On the one hand, gaming, and on the other hand, e-commerce. Because if you then look at the metaverse concepts, the two different or the three different types of businesses are coming together. You have the games, you have music, you have sports, you have brands, and all of them, they want to be more interconnected. If we're just going to concentrate on, for example, gaming, then we're not going to understand how the music artists, the brands, or the sports companies are thinking. And what we want to do is engage with all the different types of stakeholders, provide the services that can be the glue between the two. And that is a very difficult thing to juggle with a small team that we have today. But that's luckily something that we can take care of when we're moving forward in 2022.
But how has it worked, Tim? I mean, you're saying that you need to know what musicians want out of, you know, such a thing. I mean, how do you know how they do it? Right.
So let's take one musician and the sandbox. If that musician wants to create NFTs and they want to have that represented within the sandbox, right now they have one choice. They go to the sandbox, they work around the deal, around the IP. The sandbox owns the NFT that they would create for that musician. It's their token contract that they're creating, and there's a rev share between the two. That is not the vision that we're most excited about, because what we understand when we're talking to the brands is they want to own the NFT contract, because this is where their intrinsic value lies. The IP business is out there. They want to continue to own the IP. So thus, translate that, they want to own the smart contract, because the smart contract is where all the IP license holder, all the recurring value would come towards. What they want to do is they want to have let's take a brand as an example. They want to create Nike wants to create the digital shoe. Yeah. They want that shoe to be able to be presented within the sandbox. And when you're playing around in the sandbox, the Nike shoe is worn by one of the avatars. How can Nike create the NFT contract and have a specific avatar that has that digital asset linked to that NFT contract that Nike owns and not the one that the sandbox owns? Mm-hmm. So you need to create a twinage or a parallelism that says, even though that contract is not owned by the sandbox, you need to be able to bridge the two and make sure that the sandbox knows that NFT held by this user from Nike actually gives them the right to have that shoe represented in my digital world. Mm-hmm. And that's just for that one world, right? Then you have all the other different metaverses. So what Nike then would want to do is they have that smart contract. They have a deal with the sandbox. They might have a deal with Decentraland. They might have a deal with Fortnite. And essentially, they want to map all of that to their own token contract.
Got it. Okay. So are you saying that, you know, Nike wants to build whatever, the new Jordans, right? And they want that represented in games like you mentioned, some Sandbox, Decentraland and stuff. And they want to have people who wear that shoe, whatever, right? And have that represented on an avatar. And you're saying currently the way that it's done is they would have to go to one of those games like Fortnite or Decentraland, and they would have to do it one by one with that metaverse, with that game, but it would be much better for the brand to do it once for themselves, to own the intellectual property, to own the IP of that product, and then just have maybe an avatar move from Fortnite to the sandbox or to Decentraland wearing that same shoe.
It doesn't necessarily have to be that the avatar moves. It means that all of those different worlds, they have a representation of that avatar linked to that one contract. So okay. It could be that you would say in the sandbox, it could be like the shirt that they have, while in the central land, it could be the baseball cap. It doesn't even have to be the same object. It's a brand representation that you would have to bring to that specific item.
Mm-hmm. And what interest would like Fortnite or Decentraland or the Sandbox have in giving that intellectual property to Nike? Wouldn't they always be interested to just have that on their platform, to have some kind of exclusivity or uniqueness to them?
It depends on what the model is for the companies, right? In Fortnite, yeah, I do think that they would probably not want that. But in open metaverses, they want to have the more interaction as possible. If then you can work with different brands that can come in and they can create a rev share to participate within their community. Well, if a brand then is going to say, okay, Roland Garros is happening this year. There's going to be a digital version happening within the game. We're a sponsor of Roland Garros, and we're also going to have ticket sales so that you can watch the game exclusively within that. And perhaps there's an additional perk or benefits for everyone that participates over there. Then they're driving an audience also to participate in that specific game.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying. So maybe let's move back to Venly and what you guys do. So, I mean, what's your business model?
Our business model is really to be the tech provider. So if you're looking at all the different products and services that we have, we're typically very traditional, having a monthly license, and then we look at the usage that the company is using, and we just try to be as compatible as possible. Then, on the other end, if we're looking at the marketplace services, there we're taking a small percentage of revenue. So depending on which product our clients are using, they either fall under a SaaS model, and sometimes they fall under a percentage of sales.
Interesting. Is that hard to? I mean, you're still a startup, right? You're growing quite a bit, but I mean, you're still not a huge corporation. So, is that hard to manage both business models in the current state where you are?
Not necessarily the business models that's hard to manage. It's hard to create separate teams to be able to drive both tracks forward without any hiccups. But essentially, since we had to do it, it has been a big benefit for us to actually take the scope. Because otherwise, we're only always solving a very small piece of the puzzle. And usually, you would say it's better to focus on one thing and not mind all of the others. But at a certain point in time, you need to have a service or a company that would be able to aggregate and build something that crosses different solution stacks that you would need. Because if you only focus on one piece of the puzzle, you're still missing the other 99 pieces that you would need.
Whew, okay, I think I need to breathe because this has been really interesting for me. I mean, to understand, you know, the whole concept of Web3 and kind of the potential disruptive powers that are kind of, you know, with this whole technology. And I find it interesting to see that you do operate as kind of a traditional business model, right, with SaaS and marketplace. But and you position yourselves between Web2 and Web3 in a way, as you enable Web2 companies to, you know, work on the Web3. I find that really interesting as a positioning. If you don't mind, I would. We're almost getting to the end of our conversation, so I would love to, end our interview as I always do on this podcast with rapid fire questions. Are you ready, Tim?
As ready as I can be, I guess.
Okay, yeah, you'll get through it. So first off, we talked about Spotify in the beginning. And so you kind of already answered the question, but I'm still going to ask you, would you buy Spotify stocks today, looking at the potential of, you know, smart contracts maybe disrupting this industry?
Answer is no, because I barely or don't buy stocks.
Oh, so you invest your money in crypto?
That I do, yes.
Okay. Next question. You know, from your perspective, how much fraud is going around in the crypto space? How many? I mean, there's so many pump and dump schemes. You know, you can see you wrote a blog article about hacking into accounts, and how much is a bit unregulated. So, I mean, how much of this is fraud and a Ponzi scheme?
I would consider that a lot of it is fraud, in the sense of that if there is no regulation, and I think there should be regulation, you can create fake volume. That is essentially something that you would want to avoid if you're doing a marketplace. We never create fake volume. And in that sense, that can really pump up the idea that something is really worthwhile. So I would say there is still a need for more compliance, for more, KYC and KYT transaction recording.
So is this the Wild West of Web3?
It's not the Wild West. We're going into more regulation, and we already are seeing it coming and happening. And there is already regulation for everything coming into crypto. So coming into crypto, everybody is being regulated. Everybody is being tracked. While you're using crypto and doing transactions, you're still being tracked, but it's not coming up in the forefront. There are big companies that are coming up that are doing exactly that, monitoring all the transactions that are happening and that have happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. Next question, Tim. This might be a stupid question. I'm still going to ask it. Why are there so many cryptocurrencies out there?
Because they can create their own in-game economy. If they create a good utility for their own token and they can create a community around that and they can create engagement around that, then every loyalty token that exists out there in the world could essentially become a cryptocurrency. If you then look at every company that exists and every company that has a loyalty and engagement token, well, that can become a cryptocurrency. So in the end, we don't have that many cryptocurrencies.
Mm. Interesting. Let's shift gears for a little bit. What do you do, Tim, when you log off work?
I take out my phone and I continue to work. No. So usually what I do is I spend time with my wife and baby girl. So my daughter is 2 months old.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And next to that, I work.
Okay, so you don't play Axie Infinity or Sandbox.
Well, that's a little bit working as well, right? So I don't. I play around with it a little bit, but no, I don't know them well enough to really understand what's going on in the Axie world.
Got it. Okay. Next question. Imagine all of COVID-19 gets sucked out of the world. What do you do the next day?
Get on a plane and be on a conference or something like that.
Ooh, where does that plane go? Thailand?
I imagine it goes all over the world. Before COVID hit and we were only a four-man team, I was already on flights every month, where for me, COVID is a blessing. We can build our company, build our team, do virtual meetings and engagements, and you don't need to be in New York or in Silicon Valley to build your business. So, for me, let's keep COVID around for another couple of months.
Okay. Funny enough, I'll just ignore the last sentence, but a lot of founders, they say the same thing. They say that, you know, actually, well, obviously, you know, it pretty sucks for the world, but for their business, it's been quite a blessing because they were able to work heads down and build something up and, you know, didn't have so much distraction.
Yeah. So. You need to understand the competitive disadvantage that European companies have. If you look at the landscape of blockchain technology, you have some events happening in Berlin. You have some events happening in London. But if you then go to California or you go to New York, there are 10, 20, 30 events happening on a monthly basis. All of them are important to be at or to go to because the social interaction at that point is, of course, better than the digital interaction. Thanks to COVID, we leveled the playing field. It's digital for everyone.
That's interesting. So you're saying that, you know, Europe as a hub for this technology and for businesses in that space, the Web3 crypto space, it's actually a blessing. That's really interesting. Never thought about it that way. Yeah. Next question, which book should our listeners read?
Which book? I Last one that I recollect very well is Start With Why, Simon Sinek. I would still recommend everyone to read that one. Classic, what you call it? Ooh, I have to look at my bookcase. The Magic of Thinking Big.
I haven't heard that one before. Sounds interesting. Should you read the Simon Sinek Start With Why book after you saw his YouTube, you know, his TED Talk? Or is it still worthwhile to read the book?
It's still worthwhile to read the book. Why? There are many analogies that that are in the book, and there are many references that you'd like to read. But of course, the more business books that you read, they always come back a little bit more in one form or in the other. So if you've not read many books, that is one I would say it's very simple, it's very engaging, and it touches to the point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last question, Tim. We're already at the end of our conversation, so let me hit you with the last question. What is the best advice you personally have ever received?
The best advice that I've ever received? That I shouldn't care too much about what other people think.
Oh, well, who gave you that advice?
It's one of my mentors that actually gave that advice. So the guy that actually brought me into IT, so Kurt, he's quite eccentric, I must say. And I couldn't really understand that he would like be a little bit dressed like a hippie going to these big board meetings to tell people what to do. It just dawned on me what he was doing. He was just being himself, but he was always bringing value to the companies that he entered in. So in that sense, I got to learn to think more a little bit for myself, to be less worried about other people's opinions. It doesn't mean that I don't listen to other people's opinions, but just be happy with who you are and take yourself at face value.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting thing. Do you remember the circumstance where he gave you that advice? So what you were struggling with?
It wasn't really like a circumstance. It was mm-hmm. just like we were walking up and we were having this conversation, and he was just telling me that like you shouldn't worry about it. And it was just a profound moment for me, but in a circumstance that was just like a normal day to day conversation.
Interesting. Tim, I don't think we can say that, you know, we went to the bottom of the barrel when it comes to Web3 and crypto, but there's so much, to unpack. And I find it a really interesting topic. And thank you, Tim, for, helping me to start my journey down that road, because what I really believe is that it's worthwhile to understand all the things going on now. Because, I mean, I'll share a little bit of, my personal story. When the whole Bitcoin thing a couple of years ago, when the price of Bitcoin exploded, a lot of people around me were going crazy, and they think this is the next thing. Then the stock, the price crashed, and everyone was kind of down a bit. But I believe the evolution that happened with Ethereum, smart contracts, and the picture, I can really see that this is the start of something really interesting to get into. So thank you for being on the show and helping me to, start my way down that barrel too.
Thank you for having me, Alexander. It was a real pleasure to actually be on your podcast.